This is special coverage from NBR News on today's terrorist attacks. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Here's a review of today's story. The biggest act of terrorism ever was carried out this morning when four hijacked commercial flights were crashed, two into the World Trade Center towers in New York, one into the headquarters of the U.S. military, and one on the ground outside of Pittsburgh. Government offices around the country were closed. The U.S. military forces around the world were put on the highest alert status.
NBR's Don Gagne is here with us in the studio. Don, earlier you were with the president in Florida, and the president has left there. Where has he gone?
The president first left Florida and went to, the first time we saw him make any kind of an extended statement on this, he was at an air base in Louisiana. We were then told he was going to another undisclosed location. And just in the last hour or so, we found out that he's outside Omaha at another air base, Offutt Air Base, the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command, and he is there until late this evening when we're told he is coming back to the White House.
Well, now, the president and the leaders of Congress were removed to so-called secure locations, I suppose, in the event that they had to conduct government business in some safer place than Washington.
Right, right.
Do we assume that the fact that they're bringing him back to Washington means that people feel that it's all right to be here now?
That's hard to say. They may not have felt comfortable bringing him back here right away when this was unfolding so rapidly today. But I think they may also feel the need to have him back in Washington and to get ready to make some sort of a statement to the American people, though we don't know when that could happen. Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, have been at the White House, two of the few people in the White House since this morning. And he has been in contact with them. But again, he will be joining them at the White House tonight.
And we are expecting perhaps a statement from the president. We've just seen sort of fragmentary remarks from him so far, but some sort of major statement?
We will hear something from him, but we can't say at this point when it will be. And it could be late this evening before he actually gets back. So I think while everybody is waiting to hear something from him, we don't know when yet.
Thanks very much, Don.
Thank you.
NBR's White House correspondent Don Gagne.
Americans historically have felt insulated from acts of terrorism such as we experience today. The attacks on the World Trade Center building in New York and the Pentagon in Washington are distinguishable not only for their size but also for the apparent planning and resources that made them possible. Alan Brinkley is a professor of history at Columbia University in New York. He says today's events will force the country to view its relationship with the rest of the world differently, even as we make efforts to find those responsible for the attacks.
I think what makes this so extraordinary is the enormous scale of what happened today and the obvious massive conspiracy that was behind it, the large-scale coordination. I mean, so many things happened that are so difficult to do today that it really does make one feel that there's a much larger force at work in this event than was at work in the Oklahoma City bombing or the first World Trade Center bombing or any of the other, you know, sort of scattered terrorist events we've had in the United States.
You have to ask yourself, if somebody was able actually to successfully hijack, more or less successfully hijack, four aircraft, commercial airliners, today in the morning, why couldn't they have done it 2 months ago?
Clearly there is, they have found some way around the security mechanisms we've developed. The airports from which these planes were hijacked are not low-security airports. So, I mean, I think that's what is going to take some time to sink in our national psyche, is the magnitude of this event and the total secrecy within which it had been shrouded.
There have been comparisons made and will continue to be made with Pearl Harbor almost 60 years ago. 2,000 people died, and America begins an involvement in a world war. Is it a fair comparison today?
Well, it's a fair comparison and an unfair comparison. I mean, this is not an act of war in any conventional sense. I don't think anybody imagines that there will be an invasion of the United States or that large-scale military activity will at least immediately follow this. One of the central characteristics of our culture throughout our history has been our sense of being protected by the two oceans, that we're somehow separated from the rest of the world and safer, in a way, than the rest of the world. But I think what this does is demonstrate the falsity of that assumption. We are not protected from the rest of the world. We're part of the world. And that a terrorist event of this scale, which has never happened in any part of the world, to my knowledge, nothing of this magnitude has happened in any other nation, has happened here, it's going to be a very hard thing, I think, for Americans to assimilate.
Professor Brinkley, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Alan Brinkley is a professor of American history at Columbia University in New York. Earlier today, we spoke with John Axisa, who was on his way to work when the first plane hit the World Trade Center.
It was such a surreal thing. It's just, I think I commented out loud to the people around me, it looked like the end of the world. And each time I thought it couldn't get worse, it did. The next thing I saw were people jumping from the building. And I will never see anything so horrible in my life. These people just choosing their way of death as opposed to succumbing to flames and smoke, I guess.
What kind of view did you have of them, and how did you know for sure they were jumping?
I was across the street. These were people, I could see their clothes. I saw a gentleman in a red shirt, and his arms weren't waving or nothing. He just calmly jumped, and seven in all, I believe. I didn't see them all. I turned my head in horror, but each time someone else would jump, the whole crowd would break into hysterics. And then the second building went up. I heard no aircraft. I was right across the street. I was still refusing to believe it was an aircraft at that point, but the explosion was deafening. I felt the impact on the back of my head as I turned to run, and I literally thought my shirt caught fire from the heat. It felt like the flames touched me. I know they didn't. I know how ridiculous that is, but it was just that hot. It was that insane. The wind, the debris, people were falling to the ground, and I wanted to stop and help them, but self-preservation told me to just keep going. The building was going to fall, which eventually it did do, but by that point I was four or five blocks away.
Mr. Axisa, thank you for talking with us.
Sure.
Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
John Axisa speaking with us from New York earlier today.
Here's a review of today's story about the biggest terrorist attack ever. Both World Trade Center towers collapsed this morning after two hijacked commercial airliners crashed into the skyscrapers. Fire sparked by the collapse continued to burn. The U.S. military headquarters was also attacked. One side of the Pentagon collapsed under another commercial jetliner. A fourth plane crashed on the ground 80 miles outside Pittsburgh. The Federal Aviation Administration has stopped all domestic commercial flights until at least noon tomorrow. Financial markets were closed today and will be closed tomorrow as well. We're following this story throughout the rest of the day and tonight. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
This is special coverage from NPR News of today's terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington. In Washington, I'm Noah Adams.
I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And in New York, I'm Robert Siegel. Chaos was unleashed today in New York and Washington as the United States was hit by the worst terrorist act in history. Four commercial jets were hijacked and crashed into civilian and military targets, two into the towers of the World Trade Center in Manhattan, one into the Pentagon, and one plane crashed outside Pittsburgh. Hundreds of people were aboard those planes that crashed, and the death toll could be in the thousands. Earlier this afternoon, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani had this to say to the residents of his city.
Everybody should, in their own way, say a prayer and ask God for help and for assistance, and also ask God to give us the strength to overcome this, because I know we're going to need strength to overcome it. And I want the people of New York to be an example to the rest of the country and the rest of the world that terrorism can't stop us. American democracy is much stronger than vicious, cowardly terrorists, and we're going to overcome this.
You were listening to New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. We're joined now by Marianne McCune, who is a reporter with WNYC in New York City. Right now, she is at the major triage center just north of the World Trade Center. A triage center has been set up to handle people being brought out of the building, who are then, I assume, sent on to other hospitals. Marianne, you spent the day downtown at the bombing site. Can you tell us what is going on now at the triage center?
Now it's really just people are poised to receive patients, but the action is more preparation than anything else. They had a triage center set up further south earlier, but because 7 World Trade Center is considered still very dangerous and it's still burning. They moved it up here. Now this is being called Ground Zero. They have a team of ambulances, a team of triage nurses, an area set up for non-critical trauma, psychiatrists, counselors, and clergy. But again, everybody is poised for action. There aren't a lot of patients coming in now. The mayor says that they said earlier that more than 1,000 rescue workers are out there working to get people out, and there are also teams of volunteers from all walks of life all over. But it's dangerous down there, and it's been difficult to get close enough to actually rescue people. We did just have a round of applause on this corner where there are quite a few people now, because a fire truck emerged covered with this thick gray debris that's been blowing everywhere down here.
When you look around you right now at down in that part of Manhattan, we were told that it almost has blocked out the sun, the dust and the ash from the collapse of the two buildings.
Absolutely, the smoke has at certain times gotten so strong and high that it's blocked out the sun. The ground is covered with this sort of thick gray dust, and there are papers and pens and all kinds of things that you would imagine came from offices all over the ground. Earlier, I drove over with some triage nurses from a hospital, the hospital that's actually nearest to the World Trade Center, but where the action had died down since this morning. So these triage nurses were looking to go where they could make themselves more useful. But on the way over, it was, I hate to keep saying this, and I keep hearing people say this, but it looks like a war zone.
Have you talked to people who were in the building and came out of it?
Yes. Earlier in the day, actually, when the first two collapses were happening, I was at the place where people were running to get away from it. So each time there was an explosion or a collapse, there would be a wave of people fearing for their lives. And the first waves would be people who weren't that close, and then more and more people showed up who were covered with soot and describing things like, being on the 87th floor of the World Trade Center and running down 87 flights, getting out just before a collapse happened. People described seeing people jumping out of windows from very high up in the building. And then the dust and the debris after the collapses was so strong that you couldn't see anything. One person described thinking he was lost in a cloud of dust and then being saved by the flash of a photographer's camera.
Marianne, do you have any sense of whether most of the people who were in the building got out or not?
It's very, very difficult to know that at this time. I mean, even the mayor is hesitating to estimate. He said in his press conference that he guessed there were 10,000 people, he said this is a guess, so that there were 10,000 people in the building. And then he talked about, but many of those people may have been rescued. He said that 1,500 people were brought over to New Jersey, the New Jersey shore on ferries, so certainly that many were saved. And 600 people have, this was earlier in the day he was saying this, but the 600 were treated in local hospitals,
right.
150 removed by EMS. But now it's just very difficult to tell.
Thanks very much, Marianne.
Thank you.
Marianne McCune is a reporter with WNYC in New York City.
Our colleague Robert Siegel is also in New York. Robert, the difficult thing here, I guess, throughout this day is to avoid panic among the people there.
Yeah, I think what I saw today, and this was in Midtown Manhattan, so it wasn't immediately in the area of destruction. It wasn't panic. People were obviously very anxious. I didn't hear much gallows humor from anyone. This was not like a blackout where there's some element of fun to it, not at all. On the other hand, although I guess we really won't know what truly happened all over New York City today for a while, I didn't get any sense of violence or looting or anything like that.
In the city, the mass transit, let's say people mm-hmm. wanting to leave that city very quickly this morning, the subways were shut down, the bridges were closed. How could people do that?
Subways were shut down. Buses were still running. Service was not full, but a bus would pass periodically, and they would be packed with people. The logistical feat of New Yorkers getting to work, of people coming from the outer boroughs, from the suburbs of the city, in and then out every day, is fairly miraculous without something like this happening. Then for New Yorkers to get to work, drop off children, collect them at the end of the school day, and put all that together is a rather difficult piece of urban logistics. If you can imagine how complicated this was as people tried to get back to their homes early in the morning without benefit of trains, simply headed walking in the right direction, tried to hitch rides with vans as they came. Then you'd learn that one tunnel or bridge was open, but only outbound. Lots of people improvised. Lots of people walked enormous distances today.
I suppose, too, there was throughout this day sort of a desperate need for people to get in touch with spouses and with children throughout the city.
Yes. I mean, the difference between an event like this and anything even remotely similar that might have happened 10 years ago is the soundtrack of it is thousands of people in cell phone conversations talking with somebody, a loved one, or calling the office, or just trying to tell someone, I'm okay. I wasn't at the office yet this morning, so I'm all right. So that was going on constantly. And at every payphone, you'd see a line of people waiting to get to the payphone, obviously to connect up with people at home or with the caregiver of the children to explain what to do with the kid if you were stranded in Manhattan.
New Yorkers have been tested before, of course, but never on this scale.
Nothing has ever happened like this, and the measure of the magnitude of it is that as you walk around Midtown Manhattan and you look south and you look downtown, you would think that there is a huge fire perhaps 10 blocks away, and then you realize, no, that cloud of smoke that's hanging over Manhattan is the cloud of debris and smoke and dust that's gone up from where the World Trade Center towers should be. It is vast, and it is oppressive.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Noah.
Our colleague Robert Siegel in New York.
NPR's Steve Inskeep has been around the city of Washington today checking out reports of car bombs and other attacks. He spent most of his time at the Pentagon, where one of the hijacked planes crashed into the building shortly after 9:30 this morning. Steve, can you walk us through what happened in Washington today?
Well, Linda, I suppose the best place to witness the beginning of this day, and it's unfortunate to phrase it that way, was on top of a hill not too far from the Pentagon. I spoke to a gentleman who was here in Arlington this morning. He said he heard an enormous roar. He looked up just in time to see a plane flying very low overhead, flying so fast, he said, that he had no idea even what kind of a plane it was. And then that aircraft smashed into the Pentagon. We're looking right now, Linda, and I hope you can hear me as a helicopter passes over. We're looking right now at the result of that, an enormous gap in the Pentagon, in the wall. We're told that this plane crashed through the outer ring of offices, through a courtyard, through the next ring of offices, through another courtyard, and into the third ring, and flames burned intensely for quite some time. Just now does it look like they're beginning to get the fire almost under control and the smoke is diminishing.
But with all that, apart from the area of the direct hit, people were evacuated from the Pentagon office building.
People were evacuated from the Pentagon office buildings, that's correct. And it's interesting that some people had different reactions, though. There were, we're told, and I've met a number of people today, who actually went toward the fire, actually went toward the explosion and tried to find people, tried to help people, tried to bring them out. Pentagon officials have told us that at least one man who did this, who was outside the building, raced into the building, tried to bring people out, and was severely burned as a result. So there are quite a few stories of heroism here. Other people have simply tried to stay out of the way and kept a nervous eye on the sky. There have been false alarms and alerts all over Washington today, alarms about possible attacks on the State Department, on the Capitol, alarms about more airplanes in the sky, unidentified, and questions about where they were heading. On a couple of occasions here at the Pentagon, people went running away from the building at the urging of the police in order to stay clear in case another aircraft were to crash. But for the most part, people have stayed calm.
When I was out earlier today, I noticed that the only planes in the air were military aircraft. What is the military doing in this country and around the world?
Well, the military has put itself on what they call Force Protection Condition Delta. And what you need to know is that that is the highest state of alert that they have. They've changed the alert system they used to have during the Cold War. And U.S. military forces around the world are on their highest state of alert and prepared, we presume, to act. Although, of course, the first question is, if you're going to strike back, what do you do? In the meantime, two American aircraft carriers have shoved off from Norfolk today. They've headed up the East Coast simply to be in position to assist in any way that they can, providing helicopters or other transport, hospital facilities, anything else, with the damage here in Washington and also up the coast in New York City.
Thanks very much, Steve Inskeep.
Happy to help.
NPR's Steve Inskeep will be back in a moment with more special coverage of today's attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. This is NPR. This is special coverage from NPR News on today's terrorist attacks. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. In a time of national crisis, we are used to turning to the federal agencies in Washington for regular updates and news conferences. That has not happened today. The only federal official we've seen, except for brief remarks by the president, was his assistant, Karen Hughes. She spoke this afternoon at the FBI to assure the country the president is working on the issue.
He is in continuous communication with the vice president and key members of his cabinet and national security team. Vice President Cheney and our national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, are in a secure facility at the White House. I have just come from there. The Secretary of Transportation and other members of our White House senior staff are gathered at a command center there, and we are coordinating with other branches of our federal government.
Bush aide Karen Hughes speaking earlier today. We're joined now by NPR's Barbara Bradley. Barbara, you've been at the FBI. What's going on in official Washington right now?
Well, as far as the FBI is concerned, we don't know a whole lot about what's going on. I've been standing outside of the FBI building since the first thing in the morning. The only statement, the only official statement that they would give us is that, first, they have dispatched investigative teams to all the disaster sites. Second, that their first priority is to help the wounded. And finally, that they're working with other government agencies. So it's not been a whole lot of communication.
So when you don't have things being given to you by people in government, what do you do? How do you find out what's happening?
Well, you know, you make phone calls when the cell phone is working, which today didn't work a whole lot. Today I spoke to a longtime FBI profiler, Clint Van Zandt, who's an expert on terrorism and specifically has been watching a major suspect, Osama bin Laden. And Van Zandt said that the U.S. did have some early warning signs. For example, someone from his organization wrote a British newspaper last week and threatened an attack on the U.S. And there was an earlier warning about 3 weeks ago. And at least Van Zandt said that he was not surprised about the timing since, as you know, one of bin Laden's top lieutenants was about to be sentenced tomorrow in New York City for his role in the bombings of the two U.S. embassies in Africa.
So with the warnings that apparently were out there, why could this attack not have been predicted?
You know, we get dozens of warnings every week, sometimes every day, and it's really nearly impossible to know which ones are legitimate or not. Experts say it takes a long time to get the infrastructure for this kind of strike in place. I mean, you have to train the pilots, you have to do the logistics, the planning, you have to raise some money. But once that plan is set up, the strike can happen at any time, and they can just choose to wait until a significant date. And that may be what's happened this time.
Now, tell us, is anything known about any of the victims in any of the deaths at the Trade Center or the other airline crashes today?
I don't believe we know we don't know the specific number of victims yet. We don't even know that. We do know the identity of one victim. She was Barbara Olson, who's a very influential Republican activist and is also the wife of the Solicitor General, Theodore Olson. She was on the American Airlines plane that crashed into the Pentagon, and apparently she was able to call her husband and say that the plane was being hijacked and that all the passengers had been moved to the back of the plane. And then, of course, the plane crashed into the Pentagon. It's kind of a chilling scene to think of.
Thank you, Barbara. NPR's Barbara Bradley.
The federal government sent workers home mid-morning today, shortly after the American Airlines plane crashed into the Pentagon. Federal workers poured out of buildings in downtown Washington, creating a citywide traffic jam as they tried to make their way home, adding to difficulties for ambulances and fire trucks trying to reach the Potomac River bridges on the way to the destruction at the Pentagon. Patricia Rivera of Denver and Phil Gentry of Portland, Oregon, were in the city for a meeting at the Small Business Administration. Their meeting was canceled for now, and they were walking toward the bridges.
First time in my life, I saw cops with guns, and I'm in the street, M16s, and I've never seen that.
You have to treat this almost as a war zone, and the safe thing is not to be where there's visible buildings that might be of interest to terrorists, or and a subway would be one of those. So we're walking and trying to stay away from the main federal buildings.
Near the arena where Washington's basketball teams play, we ran into Erica Thornburg, who, along with some colleagues from the Veterans Administration, decided to go to lunch.
The streets are blocked, people aren't moving, the police are trying to direct traffic. Most of us don't have enough gas to get home if we're going to be sitting in traffic like this for 3 hours. So we might as well eat.
George Ray was walking away from the mall in the complex of federal office buildings, hand in hand with his wife, Betty. He'd hiked over from his offices at Housing and Urban Development to find her.
I could see out my window the billowing smoke coming out of the Pentagon. This is terrible. There's panic in the streets. We'd never thought we would be attacked like this. Never, ever.
And I think the worst part of it is trying to get in touch with your loved one. But as you can see, the streets are just packed. No one's moving. Cars are standing in place for half an hour, or an hour more, just still at the same stoplights.
From the glittering white obelisk of the Washington Monument to the immense dome of the Capitol, the Washington Mall looked almost normal. But the people drifting along its paths were workers sent home. Smoke was rising over the Smithsonian Museum from the fire at the Pentagon, and the white buildings bathed in bright sunshine were completely empty, evacuated, including the Capitol building and the six big office buildings that house members of the House and Senate. There was a loose cordon of Capitol police keeping people off the grounds. A few people across Constitution Avenue gathered in the deep shade of the park. We passed a parked car where a dozen people were gathered around a car radio. And we stopped for a moment to listen as a limousine driver gave directions to pedestrians trying to get home.
Andrews is shut down.
So the green line is running.
The green line is open.
Oh, okay.
This is my job. I know the city. I've been paying attention to what's been going on the radio, and every bit of information that I get, I just pass on. This is total gridlock right here.
That was Jess Pipkin, who parked his limousine on the mall this morning and tried to help.
Here is a review of today's story about the biggest terrorist attack ever. Right now, medical centers in New York are treating people injured in this morning's attacks. Two hijacked commercial jetliners crashed into both of the World Trade Center towers. The towers caught on fire and then collapsed into the street below. And this afternoon, another building at the World Trade Center complex has collapsed. Police estimate that thousands of people have been injured and killed in New York. The Pentagon was also attacked. We'll be following this story throughout the rest of the day and tonight. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.